You may have heard of Deadwood Dick. Did you know that he was black? So were Stagecoach Mary, Cherokee Bill, and many other legendary frontiersmen. 34 years ago, William Lauren Katz, an award-winning author and historian, wrote about them in the internationally acclaimed The Black West. The book has just been released by Harlem Moon Broadway Books in a newly revised edition, and it brings Mr. Katz to my show today. Hello.
Glad to be with you.
When did you realize that there was a lot of untapped material on the roles of blacks in the Western expansion?
Well, I started writing on black history many years ago as a school teacher, and I kept stumbling on all of this material, that there were black cowboys, cowgirls, settlers. I mean, it's fabulous. If I can just give you a kind of fast breakdown of it, people are amazed to find that, for example, in Oklahoma alone, between 1890 and 1910, there were 32 all-black towns. Not only were they there, but they stressed education and drove the illiteracy rate, this is just about 25, 30 years after slavery ended, down to 4 and 5%.
But hadn't they actually, many of them, come there against their will as slaves of Indians who had been forced into Oklahoma as part of the Trail of Tears, Andrew Jackson's Trail of Tears?
Some of them, yes, some of them had it. That's a complicated story. I also wrote a book called Black Indians.
I know, we'll get to that in detail.
But let me just go on with the West for a minute to point out, we now know that the average trail crew of 11 that drove cattle up the Chisholm Trail after the Civil War, two or three were African Americans, another one or two were Mexican Americans or Native Americans. We now know that 20% of the time when the bugle blew and the cavalry rode into the rescue was the Buffalo Soldiers, the black cavalry, the 9th and 10th cavalry units.
So why do you think they disappeared? I mean, John Ford usually insisted on having at least one black character in his westerns, but that was pretty much it.
That was it. I met and got to know and got quite friendly with Woody Strode, the actor. And he could have used a lot more roles, he said.
This book also was inspired by a conversation with Langston Hughes, wasn't it?
Yeah. I had written to Langston Hughes about my first book because I was quoting from his writing in three places. And one night, I think it was late 1966, early 1967, just before he died, my phone rang, and there was Langston Hughes on the other end. And he said, "This book that you're doing, tell me about it. What is it?" I said, "Well, it's a school text on black history for school children." He said, and then he did this. He said, "Don't leave out the cowboys." I think he said it twice. And the more I pondered what he said, the more I realized he was getting at a very fundamental American point, that we're ever going to get our act together racially in this country. We have to have our history straight. And the black cowboys and so on that rode across the Chisholm Trail, rode all across all of the trails, have to ride across the pages of history.
But you intended this initially as a school text? That's not the way it's turned out.
No. The Black West is not. It's been used as a school text.
Or but chapters, it was not anyway.
Right. Intended as that. No, what I've done here is devise a picture history. I figured people wouldn't believe me if I didn't put up these pictures. So that's why it is 300 pictures and goes on.
Well, this is not the first edition of the book, as I said earlier. It was first published 34 years ago. What made you go back and revise it?
Well, a lot of research has come out. I mean, I've even been engaged myself with my research in Africans and Native Americans. And a lot more material has come out on some of the things that I wrote about back in 1971. Things had to be revised. New material on certain individuals came out, and even certain individuals surfaced who weren't known about.
Well, in general, trappers, cowboys, and the like didn't keep written records. Did that make the job of writing this history a little more difficult than it might have been?
Yes, particularly for me, because I like to emphasize first-person accounts. But in the documentary sections, I have come up with a lot of first-person accounts from Library of Congress letters and so on.
And a lot of pictures, and there are more pictures here than there were in the first edition as well?
Yes, there are more pictures and some better pictures, too. I'm very proud of those pictures.
How do you wind up even identifying the people involved?
Well,
I mean, you have a picture.
Yeah.
There are five cowboys standing there. They're black. Is there any way of knowing who they are?
Some of the state historical societies, luckily, have identified individuals. Some of the pictures have come to me, by the way, across country from individuals who said, "Look, this is my uncle. You know, he should be in your book." that kind of thing. One of the great characters in here is Stagecoach Mary. And where I got that story from is fascinating, because Stagecoach Mary comes out to Cascade, Montana. She's a former slave. She's out there in 1882, drives a stagecoach, delivers the U.S. mail, and is as tough as nails. Now, where did the story come from? Gary Cooper.
He grew up in that town.
Yeah, he was nine-year-old kid, and here's this mountain of a woman who he thought was utterly fascinating and never forgot.
Well, she was more than just a stagecoach driver. She also ran a laundry, didn't she?
She ran.
She was as tough as nails, punched a guy for non-payment.
That's right. Fellow walked in, didn't pay. He picked up his laundry, didn't pay. She trotted after him, decked him.
Now, what about, were any of these people, did any of them play significant roles?
I think a number of them have played significant roles, and even as groups. When you talk about those 32 all-black towns in Oklahoma, there was an effort by a guy named Edwin P. McCabe to actually take Oklahoma and turn it into a black state as a refuge for black people during this era of Ku Klux Klan vigilantism. And you got Jim Beckwith. Now, Jim Beckwith, in 1851, finds a pass going through the Sierra Nevada into California that's very important to the people coming from the east going to the gold rush.
He later became a chief of the Crow tribe, didn't he?
That's correct. He became chief of the Crow tribe. He did everything. And when Universal International in 1951 made a movie, they picked the actor Jack Oakey to play Jim Beckwith. So what happened? Everybody learned Beckwith was important. Nobody learned he was indeed an African-American.
They just ignored it, or?
Well, I don't know what you call that. It's called shuffling the cards, I think. It's quite ignoring it. There was some ignoring, too.
He was also responsible for helping capture four notorious murderers that the U.S. Army was seeking.
He was all over the West. He fought in the wars in Florida. He was out in California. I think he was a Pony Express rider, too.
And met General William Tecumseh Sherman.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, there's a theme of law and order that runs through your account of blacks in the West. The first black man, the first man to be shot in Dodge City was black. I don't know if that's something that that we wanted to add to the history of
African Americans. He was shot, but he was innocent. He was just watching a gunfight between two white guys. And he took a bullet. Now, the first man arrested in Abilene and put at the New Stone Jail, he was black and he was not innocent. But his black and white buddies were so angry, they rode into town, pulled the bars out of jail, and pulled their buddy out.
Who was that?
I don't remember his name.
Oh,
so some of these guys don't come through to us with names.
Well, there are some who actually could have been as famous as Billy the Kid, you point out. Cranford Goldsby, better known as Cherokee Bill.
Bad dude. Cherokee Billy, he was, you're right. He killed almost as many people as Billy the Kid, and he was far more handsome. So when he rode away, he had a lot of women that would hide him and keep his secrets. And deputy sheriffs were also afraid to go after him because he had a rapid-fire way of firing.
And then there was Ben Hodges, a cattle rustler who had the fastest tongue in the West.
That's right.
What does that mean?
He could talk anybody out of anything in Dodge City. He talked the head of the bank into lending him money. He talked the head of the railroad into giving him free tickets. And even though he was a cattle rustler, Ben Hodges almost talked the governor of Kansas into making him chief livestock inspector.
So that would have given him free access to all the cattle he wanted?
Yep. You can just see him being played in the movie by some comedian.
And you tell an interesting story about his death and where his coffin was placed.
Yeah, here they are. He finally dies in 1929, natural causes. And they're carrying his coffin out, and one of the people there says to one of the pallbearers, "How come you're taking him up to the Maple Grove Cemetery? That's where some of our best citizens are buried." And the pallbearer says, "That's right. We want him where they can still keep an eye on him."
My guest is William Lauren Katz, author of 40 books, including such award-winning titles as Black Indians, A Hidden Heritage, Black Women of the Old West, and Breaking the Chains, African-American Slave Resistance. He has just revised his classic, The Black West, a documentary on pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States. It has been made available in paperback by it's called Harlem Moon Books, which is a division of Broadway Books.
And Random House.
And Random House. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. There are other colorful women. We talked about Mary Fields, Stagecoach Mary, but also what about Kathy Williams, who dressed as a man and tried to enlist in the Army?
Yeah, that's a very unusual story that's just come to light. Kathy Williams turned herself into William Kathy and enlisted, and he was a former slave, enlisted in 1866 in the Buffalo Soldiers. And actually, there were no physical examinations, and she served for 2 years in the Buffalo Soldiers, got an honorable discharge, and went on. And I have the only picture of her that we know exists there. We don't have her in uniform, unfortunately, but we have her tilling of fields.
Many of the women came over as mail order brides, didn't they?
Well, that's another fascinating story. Of course, everybody was interested in mail order brides because the West was such a man's place, and people needed to get married and have women out there. And what I have a focus on is a group out in Arizona, miners, who bring out young women from places like Philadelphia, New York, and Boston to marry out there. And it was a very difficult situation because these young women, and you can see from the photographs I have, and they're terribly young, they're marrying men, some of whom have lost their wives in childbirth. So some of them are walking into families with the children almost their own age, and tremendous responsibilities. And the fascinating thing here with the pictures is you look at the eyes of these brides, these taken on their wedding day, and you can see more fear than love in their eyes. Of course, they know what they're getting into now.
But also, the idea of traveling across the country under the worst conditions and then getting married to somebody you only know through a couple of letters and maybe exchange photographs with, that's got to be scary.
It had to be very frightening.
And yet, we do have all of these families because, as you thinking about some of those little towns, those all-black towns, we're talking about every job having to be filled, whether it's the barber or the teacher or the doctor or the person who represents the area to the state legislature.
Right. And in that, the black migrants to the West were kind of lucky because they traveled often from the same geographical area or town. And they traveled in this group. So it was lucky, first of all, for women because they traveled with a support network. And secondly, when the group arrived, they could hit the ground running. They could begin their town and have basically most of their services done. Whereas white people traveled kind of individually, joined wagon groups, and they had to wait for a carpenter here, a barber there, a doctor there. So it was advantageous for what happened to African Americans.
Isn't there a Brooklyn Federation of Black Cowboys?
Yes, there is, and I think there's one in Manhattan. I've met them.
The ones in Brooklyn maintain stables in Howard Beach, promote the history, culture, and legacy of black cowboys for inner-city youth. And your book, as you said earlier, has also been used as a teaching tool, especially Chapter 7, the Cowhands. But you write in your acknowledgments, initially a cause of pain and often a hindrance, it is now a matter of pride that since its origins, this project has not received a penny of private university or government funding. And that really surprised me. I would have thought that this is the sort of project that any number of groups interested in diversity would have supported.
Well, I was kind of early with this, and I was not associated directly with a university. Right now, I do have somebody who's interested in making a documentary film of some 6-7 parts based on the Black West.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that'll come about.
But even during all of the years of the various printings of this book, this is the fifth printing.
Yes.
Nobody really said, hey, William, let's, you know, I'd like to support more research into this?
No, I didn't get it. I mean, there has been a lot of research by others. I did mine on my own with, you know, the money I could scrape up. And, sometimes the things are painful, but then they give you pride later on that you survived them.
Can you tell us about a few of the other people who you write about, Nat Love or Bill Pickett or Bob Lemons?
Sure. Let's take Bill Pickett. Bill Pickett was absolutely unique as a cowboy. He invented the cowboy sport of bulldogging, which is don't try it, leap from your horse onto the horns of a steer and wrestle it into the ground. And he,
a standard in every rodeo.
It is the one of the seven rodeo acts that was invented by an individual and is claimed by Bill Pickett. There's now a Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo that a lot of people participate in. Now, Bill Pickett not only developed that act, but he would get, once he got the steer on the ground, he'd lean over and sink his teeth into the steer's upper lip, throw his hands in the air, show his only grip on that steer was with his teeth, because he knew that the steer got paralyzed if you did that. I mean, it was an incredible kind of brave act.
And Nat Love?
Nat Love was the only black cowboy that we know to write a full-length autobiography. And it was typical cowboy braggadocio. I wouldn't vouch for him, but I tell a number of his stories in there. Oh, Custer's last stand, he got there the day afterward. Frank and Jesse James, they were good guys, just misunderstood. Billy the Kid,
they would have hated him, Frank and Jesse. They were supporters of the South.
Yeah, that's right.
And the Confederacy.
They were the former guerrillas for the Confederacy.
Bob Lemons?
Bob Lemons was unique also. There was a tremendous need for horses, and there were wild Mustangs. And when the cowboys tried to round them up, they ended up killing more than they could capture and corral. But Bob Lemons developed this technique of traveling with the Mustangs, traveling with them, looking like them, eating with them, sleeping with them, and even smelling like them. And by the end of a couple of weeks, he could lead them into his own corral. I mean, you don't find many people trying things like that these days.
William Lauren Katz's revised version of his classic book, The Black West, a documentary in pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States, is published by Harlem Moon Broadway Books in a newly revised edition. I guess this is the last time you're going to tinker with this.
I don't know. It depends what further research comes up.
Meanwhile, you can see him tonight because he will be giving a talk and signing books at 7 o'clock at the Schomburg Center, the great library at 103 West 135th Street. If you want more information or would like to get tickets, you can give him a call at 212-491-2206. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. Is there another book in the works?
Well, I'm thinking of a number of things. I just want to say the book party tonight is open to the public and is free.
Okay,
you don't
terrific.
Need tickets.
Well, thank you so much again for
thank
being
you
with
for
us.
Having me on.